across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. A very sad story on the podcast. A dad talking to us about the death of his son, the trauma, and how he continues to have questions which he feels are unanswered. Have a listen. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Thank you for joining us today. A bereaved father has contacted the Nolan Show saying he still has questions over the investigation into his son's death. Matthew Campbell was a 24-year-old electrical engineer. He was killed by a falling tree in Slievegullion Forest Park in September 2018 during Storm Alley. It happened just months before he was due to get married. In March this year, it was described in court as a freak accident which could and should have been avoided. Newry Mourne and Down District Council and Matthew's employer, Lagan Construction Limited, were fined tens of thousands of pounds for breaches of health and safety legislation. The prosecution followed an investigation by the Health and Safety Executive. But Matthew's dad, Mark, says he still has questions over how the HSE in Northern Ireland handled the investigation. I spoke to him earlier, and he began by telling me about his son, Matthew.
Matthew was 24 when he was killed, born the 1st of May, 1994. And he was a fully qualified electrician. He was engaged to be married. He was about 11 months from being married when he was killed. And him and his fiancée had bought a property in Cumber, where that side of town where she was from, and Matthew and the family, both families had renovated the house, and they were almost finished when he was killed. But that's where he was living with Robin, his fiancée. And he had just changed jobs. He had worked in a firm in Williams Industrial Service in Mollusc where he had qualified, and it went under, and he had got a job, applied for five jobs, got five interviews, and chose a job.
And you must have been proud of your big son.
Yeah, very proud. He wrote poetry, so he was, and he wrote a poem when his first day had inst.
I've got it, and I'm going to read it later, if it's all right. Yeah. I've got it in front of me. Inst, obviously, very important to him and to me. Has he other brothers and sisters?
He has a sister, Ashley, who's 2 years older than him, and she has three. We have three grandchildren from her. Matthew, I say, had no children. So he didn't. But yes, he had a sister, Ashley.
So what happened, Mark?
Well, Matthew was working at the entrance to Slievegullion Forest Park. He was wastewater treatment. He wired the panels for the pumps, the wastewater plant. And that's what he was doing the day he was killed. There was a well-advertised warning, amber warning storm, Storm Alley. Forecast to come in that day, and but he was working there, and they were put off site. They closed the site. The council had closed the site, the park, and Matthew was with his manager, who is probably twice his age, and a good experience. Matthew enjoyed working with him. Now, he had only started working for the company 3.5 months, but he was enjoying doing the work, and they went back into the site to supposedly secure the place where he was working and to leave, and that's when the tree blew down and killed him.
What do you mean secure it?
Well, they were saying this would come out at the court, and they said that to make sure that people couldn't get at the electrics, that's what we were, that was put forward to us. So basically they went in to do that, the two of them. And Matthew was killed instantly, and his manager was seriously injured. In fact, I think our ambulance might have saved him.
The tree fell on him, did it?
The tree blew over and fell on him. It was approximately 150, 200-year-old beech tree, which weighed about 150 tons. And it caught Matthew straight right across his lower body and killed him instantly. That's why we were told.
Now, how did you find out, Mark?
We had no idea. This happened about 11:30 in the morning. and we found out at 20 past five, the police family liaison officer, Brendan, went and got Matthew's fiancée, who's an engineer, and she was working on a site in the Royal. They went and told her first, and she brought them into our house in Glengormley. And Pamela and I answered a knock at the door. That's what we found. It had been killed.
I'm sorry.
And our life fell apart then, 20 past five, on the 19th September 2018. And that was the start of this road we're on now.
I'm so sorry.
So it is. Thank you.
So, look, what you wanted is, you wanted, obviously, who wouldn't? You wanted answers.
Yep.
And you would have thought when something like this happens, that would be investigated immediately.
Yeah. I mean, I assumed, like everybody else, and you read some of the reports at the time, press places assumed that health and safety were dealing with it. And I asked the family liaison officer, Brendan, could they take me to see Matthew? And he drove myself and Robin's dad down to Newry. And we had to wait for a few hours because Matthew hadn't been released from under the tree. And there was another tree blew down during the rescue of trying to get Matthew's manager out and trying to recover his body. There was another tree blew down at the entrance to the park. So we had to wait for a few hours and eventually it got up to see him. And I assumed, like everybody else did, that health and safety were there and dealing with it. So basically...
And you had to You had to walk up and see your son lying in the ground.
They brought him out in the back of the mortuary. There's an undertaker's van was used, or a car, and they brought him to us about 50 yards from where he was killed.
My goodness.
And I got to see him then. So it did.
And was that important to you?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I wanted to see him. I hadn't seen him in almost a week. And thankfully, he's presentable enough for me to see him and recognise him. And basically, we got to say a wee bit with him. So we did. I just stroked his hair, his beard, and just spoke to him. And that was important to me. So it was. And they took him away then to go to for a post-mortem, I think. And the family liaison officer took us back home then. So we did. And
I don't want to cause you any discomfort this morning, but the reason I was asking those questions is just to make sure, and nobody should be in any doubt, but you know, how important it is for you to get answers around this. And so
absolutely.
And so therefore you were dealing with enough. You were dealing with trauma that none of us would ever recover from. And yet, where was the investigation? Where was the health and safety investigation?
I found out. We sat and waited. We have friends involved in the industry, and they says, who have been subject of investigations, and they told us what should happen. We waited and waited. And I had information. I spoke to Matthew the day before he was killed, and I had information which I thought was important, and I wanted to tell them.
And what was
I waited for 5 weeks. It was basically that there were certain things that Matthew had told me about the site and work that he had to do, etc., like that there.
Okay.
And I thought it was important, but maybe not. You know, it depends what the health and safety had themselves. So it gave him a bit more of a balanced view. And 5 weeks later, I got tired of waiting and I phoned the policeman the police were brilliant. The police were absolutely brilliant. So they were. And I phoned the fella Paul, who was dealing with, they described it as a sudden death. And I phoned him and I said, Paul, do you have a name and a number from anybody from health and safety? Because I need to speak to them. And what he said to me just astounded me. He says, Mr. Campbell, he says, health and safety were contacted by his inspector. And he said that they phoned back. It was like 2 hours and 9 minutes later, one after the inspector had phoned health and safety. They rang back and he said that they said they weren't interested in investigating his death or words similar. And I said, what? And he says, that's true. He says that they've never been in touch with me. We have all the statements taken and everything, photographs and video footage of the scene. and he said that they haven't been in touch with me, and that was 5 weeks after. And I said, very obvious there was no investigation, health and safety weren't investigating it. And I then started...
So an incident which resulted in the death of your 24-year-old son.
But don't forget, they didn't know whether Matthew's boss was going to survive at this stage. He was hit and miss whether he would have survived, and thankfully he has. But there could have been two deaths, and they had no more interest in dealing with anything like that, even though it was on site and they're legally obliged to investigate it.
So you kept fighting?
Fighting. I'm still fighting to this day, over six years later.
So what did you come up against?
I've come up against total... it's just incredible, some of the things that have been said to us. And now the police, in my opinion, should have compelled health and safety to come to the scene, because the more serious side of things, we were thinking corporate manslaughter, possibly. And that I found out later, that can only be investigated by the police. Can't be investigated by health and safety. And we were thinking... to be honest with you, I didn't know what was going on, because I'm dealing with my son's death, sorting out his finances, etc. And I really, it's the last thing I needed. And I've had the chase with it. Now, thankfully, Matthew was a member of Unite Union, and they came to the house after he was killed, and Susan Fitzgerald and Jackie Pollock, who was the then secretary, Susan's now the secretary, and I went to them. First of all, when I found out there was no investigation, I rang health and safety. Nobody could tell me who was investigating it. And then I went to their office and refused to leave. And I spoke to a nice fella, and he assured me somebody will ring me. And I got a phone call later that afternoon from a principal health and safety inspector to say that she would answer my questions over the phone. I says, absolutely not. I says, I'm grieving the death of my 24-year-old son. I want to speak to you face-to-face, because I've been told you aren't investigating his death. So I got a meeting the next day, and I went over for it, and I wasn't aware that the deputy chief executive, one of them, was with her, and they came down in, and they tried to assure me they were investigating it. I gave them the information that Matthew had told me, and the girl wrote it down, the Prince of Health and Safety Inspector wrote it down, and... I was expecting to get, we'll get a statement from you and all our family members who had all our information for them. And the deputy chief executive said that it was his responsibility. He said it was too dangerous for them to attend. And I says, my son was working there. I says, you have never been in touch with, how can you be investigating anything when you haven't even been in touch with the police, who have all the statements of who was there, first responders, the people that had to get the tree off Matthew and stuff like that. I says, they didn't even know that the second tree had blown down. So it shows you what sort of investigation it was. Nothing. And I says, well, you didn't tell the police, we'll be down later when the wind has subsided. You didn't tell the police we'll meet you there the next day at the scene and we'll take over the investigation. Nothing. And I left that meeting. I was very upset in the meeting. I was crying, as you would expect. And basically, it was then, just after that, I contacted the union, and Susan has been fantastic the whole way through this 6 years later.
And you got a court case then? You
eventually, they were forced to investigate it, and that took about a year and a half. And we had meetings with, in between this time, Susan arranged meetings with Sinn Féin and URI. And councillors there, they were brilliant. She arranged meetings with DUP, MLN Ballyclare at the time, and they were great. And they both got together in London and decided what sort of action they could take. And I believe they wrote a headed letter to the health and safety executive that there should be an investigation. We had meetings with the chief executive, with the person that I was told who was investigating Matthew's death, the principal health safety inspector. And during that meeting, I was astounded at their attitude. I found out just before this meeting from the police that the principal health and safety inspector, who I was told was investigating Matthew's death, was the one who actually rang up in the day and said they weren't interested. And the chief executive went on to say, they intimate that Matthew had a certain amount of responsibility for his own death. Unbelievable.
How did they explain that?
I have no idea. I looked at him straight across the table and I says, if you blame my son in any way, shape or form for his own death, I says, I'm going to take legal action against you. I says, this is unbelievable. My son worked for that company for 3.5 months. And basically that, excuse me, Stephen, I'm just going to have to compose myself a wee bit. And that was the attitude we got. And I says, like,
they suggested that.
It was almost as if they were trying to make excuses for them doing nothing. We had a meeting with the chief executive of health and safety. Now, there was no chief executive when Matthew was killed. The deputies were, I suppose you could call it, taking up his position temporarily until one was appointed. And that was the one I met 5 weeks after when I demanded to speak to them. He was the one that said it was too dangerous. This meeting was in about July 19th. And we had Susan Fitzgerald, Jackie Pollock, myself, Pamela, our daughter Ashley, and Robin, Matthew's fiance. And that's when he said that Matthew had a certain amount of responsibility for his own death. And Robin then said to him, Ashley, what you have said is against what you teach, and it's against what you is in your handbook. And I was flabbergasted. I couldn't believe that
he actually said that.
It was terrible. I was actually very angry. And I just looked across the table at him. I says, if my son is blamed in any way, shape or form, I says, I'm going to take legal action against you because this is ridiculous. You know?
There was a court case.
That's what we've been up against.
So there was a court case March 2024.
Yep. It was earlier this year. Yep.
In which Newry Moreland Down Council and Matthew's employer, Lagan Construction Limited, were both fined.
Yep.
Tens of thousands of pounds.
Yep.
What did the court determine?
The court determined, well, they pleaded guilty before. There was two offences for the council and one for Lagan. And basically they pleaded guilty before the day the jury was due to be sworn in. So we never got to hear what actually happened on the day. We heard bits and pieces of it and the judge was summing up. And they were fined, basically.
I've got it in front of me here. Newry Moreland and Down District Council entered guilty pleas to failing to make appropriate risk assessments for non-employees and employees respectively, and to failing to ensure the health and safety of employees and non-employees on September the 19th, 2018.
Yeah.
So Newry Moreland and Down Council left it right up to the day before court to do that.
They pleaded guilty December. This was in court was in March, I believe. They pleaded guilty in December. The company fought right up to the very last. So they did, and just before the jury was sworn in, they pleaded guilty.
This is Lagan Construction Limited?
Yes. Yeah.
They pleaded guilty to failing to make a proper risk assessment.
Yeah.
And they left it right up to the last minute, did they?
They did, yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, to be honest with you, Stephen, it wasn't really... I was annoyed, but it wasn't really about that. Nobody has ever apologised for what happened until the court, the council, the chief executive asked for a meeting with us through the barristers and the public prosecution barristers, and we agreed, and they came into the witness room in Newry Crown Court, and they made a genuine apology for any part they played in our son's death. And that's the first apology we have ever had.
And did that mean something to you?
It meant a huge amount to us.
Tell me why.
This didn't even have to go to court. Nobody seems to want to admit personal responsibility for something they've done wrong. And it meant a huge amount to us. Very few of us weren't crying. We were all crying in the room when they did it. And it was done in such a way, it was genuine. And I said to them, I says, nobody has ever apologised for this. And that's really all we wanted, people to take responsibility and say, I'm sorry. It never happened until that. And that was the first time that happened, and only time.
And what did they say to you?
They just said that we are genuinely sorry for any part we played in your son's death. And we talked a lot about Matthew and about things. You know, it was done in a lovely way, a meaningful way. We knew they meant it.
Who issued the apology?
It was the chief executive. She was there, and some of her, I suppose, counsellors. So it was who met with us in the court.
So that was the council?
Yeah.
What about Lagan Construction Limited?
We've had very little communication with them. So we have...
Have they apologised to you?
There's been no apologies. Health and safety haven't, police haven't. Nobody has apologised to us by the council that day.
You said to me you're still fighting. Fighting for what?
Yeah. I'm fighting to hold health and safety to account and the police to a certain degree for doing nothing. There was no investigation into my son's death. Nobody was doing anything. There was nothing. We were never going to find out what happened. And I phoned the coroner about 6 weeks after. The week after I met with the health and safety, the deputy chief executive. And I spoke to the coroner's representative. They have a liaison. And I spoke to Grania, and I told her what I had found, that health and safety weren't investigating. And she says, put it in an email and send it to me, because the coroner's not aware of this. She wasn't aware that the health and safety executive should have been. And I emailed it to her, and she forwarded it on to the health and safety executive, and then asked them, I want copies of all statements and reports, which you have made. And she did the same with the police. And basically, I've had little contact with the coroner until just there last week or a week before, because we have only ever had an interim death certificate. But now the case is finished, we can get a full death certificate now. So I also got an email to say there was going to be no inquest, and I had been asking for an inquest from the start. We're being denied that. I've been denied a copy of the report that Health and Safety did into Matthew's death, and they're blocking me from seeing that. I've had to go to the Information Commissioner.
What do you mean they're blocking you? There.
Well, they're not letting me see the report, because don't forget what the chief executive said. The report that they've done, that the court got.
The report that
Matthew's death.
The report that who has done?
That the health and safety executive have done. They carried out an investigation, they do a report, it goes to their people at the top in the health and safety, and then it goes to the PPS, and it goes before the court. Because
and they won't let you see that report about your son's death?
No.
What are they saying? What reason do they give?
The reason, well, they give reasons under section whatever it is, that it might give up some of their investigative techniques, and it might disclose how they operate and all this. It's just, they didn't want us. And don't forget, the chief executive was blaming Matthew. And I want to make sure Matthew had no blame in this at all, what they were saying. So basically, I've had to go, I've asked for an internal review. It was thrown back at me. And I went to the Information Commissioners and made a complaint to them. It's still pending. We've also had to appeal, try and get a coroner's inquest again. So my next step with that is to go to the Attorney General. This is over six years after my son's death, and all I get is obstruction. And I may ask him what any parent would want.
Completely understandable quest for answers. The whole point of doing reviews and health and safety reviews is to try to stop these things happening again. In other words, we learn from it.
Absolutely. And that's what the coroner's court, I believe, is about too, to try and prevent things like this happening again. They don't want to air their dirty laundry in public. That's my opinion on it.
Who doesn't?
Anybody in official, the police, the health and safety, and the coroner's court, because this will expose what health and safety have done or were failing to do. And they've blocked me on Facebook and Instagram. I would have put, not all comments every day or every week or every month, I would have put a comment up if they'd have put something on about what employers' responsibilities are, if there's an accident, fatality or an injury. and about the construction industry, and I would have put up a post just saying, no names mentioned, just saying that, why did you not go to the scene of my son's death and investigate it? And they've blocked me from those two platforms because they don't like me telling the truth.
Well, you sound tough.
I've had the biggest. Nobody else was going to do this for me.
But you're probably hurting big time inside.
It never goes away, Stephen. My wife and I, my daughter, it never goes away. This is something you fight every day. Depression, mood swings, it's just constant. And it hasn't been helped by this. So it hasn't.
How do you deal with the death of a child? Like, what happens?
There's no words to describe it. And there's no one way. It could be different for... Pamela grieves differently than I do, as our daughter does. We grieve at different times. The only thing I can say, I'm now able to compose myself. If I went for a walk around a shop, I just started crying. I'm sure people look at me, the tears run down my face. And I go to the grave a lot in Ballyclare, so we do. And that's my way of dealing with it. So it is. We have your own little things. Pamela does her own thing, and I do mine. We do it at different times. There's no set routine for that.
Matthew, you've already mentioned, liked poetry. And he went to the same school I went to, Enst.
Yeah.
And before we did this interview today, I read the poem that Matthew wrote about his experience at Enst.
Yeah.
Do you know what? It has connected with me so much.
Yeah.
And what your son identified with the first day in school, I described the last day in school for me as the worst day of my life.
Yeah.
You
see that from Matthew's day?
I do. And he clearly had a very close connection with RBAI.
Yeah, his first tattoo, Stephen, was Query Vera. Between the shoulder blades.
Oh my goodness.
That was his first tattoo. I have it now in my arm, although I wasn't an Estonian, but I put it in my arm. That was his first tattoo.
Do you mind if I read it?
The truth. Go ahead, yes, absolutely, please. The school now give it to all their first formers.
Do they? Wow. Wow.
And he has a prize named after him. Matthew had perfect attendance from nursery, primary school, and through Enst. Never missed a day. And he was on at the headmistress for years. Now, why are you not giving me a trophy for this? There's nobody else has it. And he left in 2012, and they called him back to present him with the trophy.
That's lovely.
And when he was killed, they named it after him. Matthew Campbell Trophy for Outstanding Attendance.
I'm looking at a photograph of Matthew now, a very lovely, beautiful, big smile young
that
man. Here's Matthew's poem. My life at Enst, on a colourful autumn morning, my fear gripping tight, a new beginning at hand, still feeling bright. A new challenge on my path, eager to commence, while walking through those double doors, feeling the ambience. The black and yellow ties waving in the wind, the black blazer drooping, the feel of a school refined. Fellow students in the quad playing with their peers, while all the first years stand stock still, trying to hold back the tears. That was me. As the years went by, seeing the word bestowed by royalty, feeling welling up within my heart, a sense of profound loyalty. My first years were fun, my middle years trying, my final years were tough, the worst was the goodbying. Having to leave that home was the hardest thing to do, but unfortunately my time was due for all sixth form of RBAI to finally give the school the final goodbye, by Matthew Campbell.
yeah, He was good at that.
He was brilliant.
So he was.
He was brilliant.
With several poems that he wrote. He wrote one about Robin, his fiance, which was read at his funeral, and another couple, which we have. So it was. But yes, he was talented that way.
How can I help? What can I do?
I don't know, Stephen. I mean, we're trying everything legally that we can do. We are...
What answers do you need me to try to get for you? What can I do?
I mean, why, they're obstructing us every time I try to do something that's thrown back at us. I mean, getting the copy of the report. I even asked for a redacted version of it. And I'm still waiting to hear from the information commissioners. We're trying to get legislation with Unite Union. We'll be campaigning for legislative change in Matthew's name to protect workers who are working in adverse weather conditions and for a review of the way HSE and I conduct themselves and investigations. I mean,
that ultimately goes up to the minister, doesn't it? That ultimately goes up.
It has to eventually, yeah, yep, yep. Eventually it does. I mean, reams of paper, corporate plans for health and safety, memorandum of understanding between the police, the courts, health and safety, and they didn't follow any of those instructions or guidelines or whatever you want to call them. And HSENI's approach, it's their corporate plan is an absolute joke in relation to Matthew's death. They didn't. It says about proportionality and how we apply the law and secure compliance. Consistency in our approach, transparency about how we operate and what we can expect, and what you can expect, and accountability for our actions. That's in their corporate plan, page number 17. Well, it's a corporate plan from 2018 to 23, and that's in their corporate plan, and we have found totally the opposite. Totally the opposite.
We'll go to the minister. We'll ask the minister some questions around this. Look, it's been an honour speaking to you today, and
thank you.
I just admire
my wife's here. My wife's here sitting beside me.
I admire the fight that you clearly have in you, and you know, it's clear that this was a son that was loved.
Very much so.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to me today. I'm going to go now before I start crying, okay? So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us today. And pass on my love to your wife as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Take care.
Well, I think we get a sense in that interview, don't we, that inexplicable pain. Inexplicable because none of us can really know what it feels like until it's happened to you of losing a child. The Health and Safety Executive, they said the HSE and I again express our utmost sympathy to the family of Matthew Campbell. We've had extensive contact with Matthew's family, they say, since this tragic incident occurred, and we acknowledge the continuing grief they're experiencing. Our approach to investigating this death, underpinned by the legislative framework in which we operate, is the same as that undertaken in similar incidents. The investigation into Matthew's death began on the day, and indeed following our investigation, which included two visits to the site of the accident, Lagan Construction and Newry Moor and Down Council, were successfully prosecuted for breaches of health and safety regulations, and significant fines were handed down by the court. I note in that statement from the Health and Safety Executive, these two visits, they said, that they took to the site of the accident. They don't say when, do they? And that's what the dad is very much highlighting. The HSE say there have been multiple detailed discussions with Matthew's family, and in the course of those meetings, some things said may have been taken out of context and served to upset his family. So there's the HSE essentially admitting, in corporate speak, that they did say some things that served to upset the family. They say in that case we apologise for any misunderstanding, and we stress that at all times we strive to be fully open and transparent with the families we deal with. Well, what did they say that they're apologising for? They're not explaining that. We will always review the way we engage, they say, with families as part of our commitment that HSE and I interaction with loved ones is open, transparent and empathetic. Well, are you being open? Because the dad is calling you out for things that he says you said to him, and you're not being explicit what you're apologising for here. It's a broad apology. The PSNI, they say that they engaged extensively with Mr Campbell's family, but that it's best for the HSE to comment. They say that the threshold for either corporate manslaughter or misconduct in public office was not met, in their view. Coroner's office. Coronial investigation of the death could not proceed at that time due to the ongoing criminal proceedings instituted against the two defendants in the case. Once the coroner had been advised that the criminal proceedings had concluded, the coroner considered whether it was appropriate to direct an inquest. As part of the process, she considered the sentencing remarks of the judge in the criminal trial. Coronial investigation can only focus on answering the four statutory questions arising from the death, namely who, when, where and how. And look, to sum this up, the coroner concluded that the four statutory questions had been answered and that an inquest was not necessary. Lagan Construction Limited, they say, has and continues to extend its sympathy to the family of Matthew Campbell for their loss. Matthew was a young and highly valued employee, they say, and the tragic events of the 19th of September 2018 gave rise to the death of a young man of huge ability, enormous potential, and who was a partner, son and brother of those that love him. There are ongoing court proceedings, they say, and it would not be appropriate to comment further while those proceedings continue. And Newry Mourne and Down District Council acknowledge the distress and heartbreak caused. The council takes its health and safety responsibilities, they say, seriously. They say they acknowledge there were failings in the health and safety process at that time and have now taken action to rectify this. Council representatives, including the chief executive, have met with Mr Campbell's family and made an unreserved apology. We accept our words of condolence cannot heal the pain of losing a much-loved son, brother and fiancé, they say. And the Department of Economy, despite us only getting in touch with them yesterday, so they haven't had much time to refer to them, they say that they're seeking advice on the issues raised by this case. Well, that's interesting, because Mr Campbell is calling for a review of the role of the Health and Safety Executive in light of this case, saying lessons must be learned. And we put that to the Department for Economy. The Union Unite, they're calling for a change in the legislation, and the Department of Economy now seeking advice on the issues raised by the case. Okay, 17 minutes to 9, 0 30 30 80, 55 55. Very difficult to follow that story, isn't it, when a mum and dad and a family lose their son, but our thoughts are with them. Now next, more than £2 million in parking fines have been written off in Northern Ireland since 2022, according to figures obtained by the DUP MLA, Dan Forsyth. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, written off in what way? What have you established here?
Thanks very much for having me on the programme. And as you say, it's a hard story to follow, and just very much my thoughts are with the Campbell family and their case, really thinking of their sad case at this time. In terms of the parking fines, so I obviously sit on the Finance Committee at the Assembly, and we're under extreme financial pressure. So we're looking to see where things are collected, where revenue is raised. And in terms of these parking fines, they've disclosed that in 23-24, they wrote off £1.3 million, and in 22-23, they wrote off £1 million. So they're issuing parking tickets to individuals, and most people are paying those, but some people aren't paying them. So the debt's being written off. So it's just a huge amount of money to be written off. And those people who are paying their fines, it's very unfair for them to think that, you know, across the board, not everyone's paying them. And I know you had the case earlier this week where we can see the difference that parking makes, you know, the ambulance access to the road, and where the Department of Infrastructure have the power to, you know, exercise their powers and having things like parking fines. If they're actually writing off the debt, you know, how seriously are they taking this?
Well, look, the statement that we've got, Dan, from the Infrastructure Minister, John O'Dowd, sorry, we didn't get the statement, the Belfast Telegraph got this statement. We've contacted the department, they haven't come back to us yet. But look, the statement that the Belfast Telegraph have got, they've said, anytime I see the word may from any government body or any political party, Dan, my brain just zones in on it, because what's may mean? And look at this statement they've given the Telegraph. The PCN recovery process involves the issuing of three statutory pieces of correspondence under the terms of the traffic management order, and in cases of non-payment may be followed up with clamping or collection of the debt using the enforcement of judgment office. So why does that not say always will be followed up with either clamping or enforcement of judgment office? What's the may about? When do they decide not to?
And I think that's a really important question here, because whenever I was asked, and I thought this was a huge amount of money in 1 year to be writing off £1.3 million, or they've had traffic wardens go out, the rules have been breached, the parking fines have been issued, many people have paid, but for over 11,000 tickets in 1 year, they have written that off. They've decided we aren't able to collect that and written it off. We don't know how many were followed up with further correspondence or clamping. And I also asked the question, how many were repeat offenders? You know, have we got some people who just continuously do this? But they didn't have that information. So is it 11,000 different people, or is it the same people in the same street? They don't have that level of data. So I'm just really concerned as to whether it's being taken seriously. And these are DFI issued parking fines. These aren't, you know, any other private bodies. Like, we have a lot of conversations around the different types of parking fines that people are issued, but this is DFI ones. Most people that receive a DFI one, they take it very seriously. And pardon me, you can see in the statistics that came through in the Belfast Telegraph that a huge proportion of people actually pay them early to get them reduced. So I'm just really concerned that I don't know how seriously the Department of Infrastructure are taking this, and it's huge amounts of money. It's increasing over £1 million a year, and you know, it's not fair on those who act within the law and genuinely pay their penalty charge notices.
The obvious questions here that most people who get a parking fine surely will be thinking is, should they not pay either? Maybe most people will think, I get a fine, my civic duty is to pay. So that's wrong of me to say. But there will be some people thinking, hold on a minute here, if somebody can get away with it, why can't I? So that's one of the obvious questions here. How are they deciding who to let off with this? What's the criteria for getting let off?
Absolutely, and it doesn't seem to be that clear. They're talking about the three pieces of correspondence, and where there is a power on a government body to issue a charge or issue a notice, it is the obligation of them to follow that up to the best of their degree. And when things are written off, it very much does beg those questions. Like you say, it's not dissimilar to the rate scenario, where there's a lot of talk about at the minute about, you know, removing reliefs and increasing rates bills, whereas the reality is, for those that are actually getting billed for their rates at the minute, over the past 5 years there's been £64 million of rate bills written off. At September this year, we had £153 million still owing from previous years. So again, you know, it's the squeeze on those who are actually paying their bills, whereas others are not paying their bills. So I think it's very, very important that right across the departments, we're looking at all of those. And in terms of this one, parking charge notices are for many different things, but a lot of them are for, you know, serious issues in terms of safety. Like, are there dangerous narrow roads where people are getting a lot of penalty charge notices, ignoring it, getting it written off, and actually the lack of safety continues there. There's very real consequences, like, as you said, like your case earlier this week with the ambulance access.
See, is there not a contradiction here? Minister John O'Dowd is saying that fines were written off, quote, when recovery procedures have been fully exhausted, right? So one of the recovery procedures would be collection of the debt using the enforcement office. So if John's saying it's only, they're written off only when recovery procedures have been fully exhausted, then how come, that would suggest that they take people to court every single time a fine is not paid.
Mm-hmm.
But how then, how is it being written off then? It doesn't make sense in my head unless someone can explain to me. If it's written off, then it hasn't been prosecuted right through the court, surely.
The response, as you say, it says they'll have three pieces of correspondence and it may be followed up with clamping or taking them through the court. And the word may is the very important word here. And this is something...
No, but John's not saying may. The minister's not saying may because he's saying recovery procedures fully exhausted. There's no may about that. That's my point. There's a contradiction in this.
Yeah, so I think that's where I need to be seeking clarity, and my colleague Deborah Irish can chair the Infrastructure Committee, and I share this across with her. I think we need to be fully established in how many were followed up by Clampen and how many were taken through the debt office, just for full clarity, because I think that the public deserve full transparency as to why these have been written off to such a high value and such a high volume of tickets.
Okay, Dan, thank you for coming on this morning. Thank you. 0303 80 55 55. Sam in Belfast. Morning, Sam.
Morning, Stephen. How are you doing?
Well, I want to know how people are getting off with not paying their fines.
Well, Stephen, it's like this here. I don't believe that people should get a fine if they're within reason where they park. I pay £280 for road tax and I should be able to park anywhere.
You're on a dopey speakerphone, are you? On your car?
Yeah.
We'll see if we can come back to you. Pull over because I can't hear you. You're coming in and out. Jared in Kilkeel. Morning, Jared.
Morning, Stephen. My opinion of the DFI is actually, if you challenge a parking ticket, they will pursue you. I mean, I have an ongoing one at the minute, and it was 2 years ago that the alleged parking offence took place. I'm getting a hearing now in December, 2 years later, for like a £90 that it would have been.
Well, why are you challenging it?
Because I don't believe that the contravention occurred.
Well, what way were you parked?
Well, I mean, I'm not... They say I was parked outside, slightly outside the box. I would dispute that.
They take a picture, don't they?
Oh, they do take a picture, but I mean, what they should do is take video footage, because I was actually moving the car at the time to let another vehicle out.
So you're suggesting you were given a ticket while you were in the car?
Yeah, Stephen, I've challenged about 5 tickets... And successfully challenged about 5 tickets off the DFI, and one of them, in fact, the traffic warden threw the ticket at me, actually physically threw it at me. I mean, they can be quite challenging, some of the traffic attendants. I'm not saying they're all like that, but some are.
Well, you would do all right at the lottery. So you've had 5 different incidents where you've got a wrong parking ticket.
Yeah.
And you've successfully... Fought harmony, Jared?
Five. But I would say probably the reason they're pursuing it against me is because I've challenged previous ones. And I think it's just a personal thing now.
So you have fought 5 different court cases and won every time?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I'll win this one, Stephen, by the way. It's in December, so I will win this
one. And what were the reasons for the other ones? How did you fight them successfully?
Well, one of the other ones, in fact, was when I sought the discovery of the traffic attendant's notes, and then got an area map that was in Uri actually at the time, and when it showed where he had given me the ticket, and like say 3 minutes or 2 minutes beforehand, he was almost a mile away. And essentially, I just said that he should have been in the Olympics and not a traffic attendant, because he couldn't have covered that distance in the time that he said he had done.
Right, well, we would need to look at the detail of this, wouldn't we? But thank you, Jared. John Laverty, Belfast Telegraph. Morning to you, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Look, you know, traffic, the reason why there are traffic codes, traffic rules with enough disruption that we're constantly talking about, is your sympathy with the people who do get let off, or is your sympathy with the people who pay?
Well, Stephen, you know yourself, there's no more nauseating feeling in your stomach than when you go back out to your car and there's one of those yellow tickets on your windscreen. But as Diane Forsyth said there, you know, the vast majority of people, you know, sigh and say, oh, and pay it. But there's around 10% of people who don't. And it's a growing number. And what's happening is, yeah, as the man from Kilkenny told you earlier, a lot more people are challenging them. People hate getting parking tickets, but there's a lot more challenging going on. Also, there's also some of these people are actually hard to find. Their car may be registered in one place, but the person may be living somewhere else. And here's the thing about it, Stephen. How much is the Department of Infrastructure going to pay to chase down somebody for £45? You know, that is one of the things. That's why a lot of this stuff...
Well, hold on a minute.
Off.
If they don't chase them down, is it not inherently unfair in those people who do pay it?
Well,
we're talking about
is.
11-odd thousand tickets here written off.
Yeah, but they chase them down to a certain extent. I mean, and what's been happening, Stephen, is, and I'm not going to obviously repeat it verbatim, but there's a lot of things on social media explaining how you get away with a lot of these things. Now, we're talking about not necessarily the infrastructure department car parking situation, but private car parks. A lot of people are explaining on social media how you get away with it. And as I say, I'm not going to repeat how you do that.
But that's different,
but
John, isn't
easily,
it? Because
it's
this
easy
is about
to find out.
This
and
is,
that's a growing. Sorry.
Yeah, that's different, isn't it? And I understand what you're saying, and there is a story there. But this is about the public parking network over which Minister O'Dowd has responsibility.
Yeah.
And for those people that get a parking ticket and they rush to pay it, because it's £90 if you pay it within, I think it is, 14 days, it's £45. 11-odd thousand people are just going, no, stuff you, and they're getting away with it.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not unique to Northern Ireland, Stephen. I mean, if in England, you know, for instance, it's the councils that run the parking schemes, and they are doing the same thing every year. They are writing off this is around the same as us, around 10% of people who don't pay. You know, what people are doing is, you know, the vast majority of people are going for the £45, so they don't want to pay the 90. But other people are waiting for 2 weeks to just before they're meant to pay it, and then they're issuing a challenge. And as you know, or as we know now, this could go on for ages. And also, it's the challenges are the main culprit. Also, trying to find people because you know you're putting something on a car, and you call in somebody's house, or you contact them. And they'll say, "Well, I wasn't driving that car." And to chase somebody down for £45, I mean, obviously it has to be done. It's the law. It's the law, Stephen. But you know, in the end, it's more financial bother than it's worth. Sometimes.
Okay, interesting. Kieran in Belfast. Morning, Kieran.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning.
But if you come up from the south and you do it, how do they get you?
What do you mean?
Well, how do they get you to pay it? Surely they don't share the same data.
Well, have you experience of this?
Maybe.
Well, spit it out.
Well, my brother, he's done it a couple of times and nothing's happened to him.
So he just pays where he wants, does he? Or
yep.
Parks where he wants.
Parks wherever he wants.
And if he gets a ticket, he doesn't pay it?
No, because you're sure they can't get you.
Steve, you're not legally obliged to pay it. And it's also the same with if you get a...
Oh, come on now, know, John. You are legally obliged to pay, are you not?
A different jurisdiction, different country. I mean, it's the same. People here get caught speeding down south, but they don't bother paying it. You know, they say it's a different country. I mean, so they're not doing it. And it's the same. I mentioned England earlier. It happens with England as well, where because the councils do it, you say, "Oh, I'm from a different council jurisdiction, so I'm not paying that council fees."
What?
That's done all the time.
I rushed to pay mine, Kieran, within a few days, so that I'm not paying 90, I pay £45.
Actually, you can afford it anyway.
And then if I miss that, if I'm raging, if I miss that, if I forget about it.
You should learn it, Stephen.
Are you sure, Kieran, your brother's doing that?
100%. Why not? If you get away with it, why not?
Kieran's brother's not the only one, Stephen.
Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, John. I'm very naive about all of this. Anyway... So over £1 million of parking fines, 1.3 million of parking fines written off because people just didn't pay them and they weren't pursued. We need to find out from the department In what circumstances are they written off? How hard do they try? What should the rest of us do? Here comes the 10 o'clock news. Good morning to you all. Friday morning, the Nolan Show from the BBC. We're a week away from BBC Children in Need. The fundraising, the challenges have already begun, though. Teams at BBC radio stations across England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have swapped the studios for the swimming pool as they attempt to swim 1,000 miles. The BBC Northern Ireland team is made up of Mark Simpson, Anne-Marie Wallace, Kate Conway and Connor Phillips. Mark and Connor are with me now from the pool, I believe. Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Connor.
Good morning, Stephen. Yes, Connor and I are here. Connor is the stats man. He's going to tell you what we've done already and what we've yet to do. Go.
Yeah, it's been a big week, Mark. Look, I've got swimming pool nose. I sound like I've got the cold. I'm just out of the water, Stephen. Right, so together with all our friends across the BBC, we were looking to do somewhere in the region. In fact, we were trying to hit 64,000 lengths. Us ourselves here at BBC Northern Ireland, collectively, so far, we have swam 21.9 miles. That's
come
worth
on.
A round of applause. In there. 21.9 miles we've done. We've got 2.1 miles to do. We're going to try and do that throughout the 90-minute window of our show. We've raised £70,000 for BBC Children in Need so
fantastic.
Far.
That's fantastic. That's brilliant.
It's been incredible, but as Mark will tell you, I think next week we'll maybe take a wee break from the pool, Mark, will we?
Oh, yes, a couple of days off. Stephen, we've found a story here. We're at Templemore Baths and on Templemore Avenue.
Oh, tell me Jim Rogers isn't up there in his budgie smugglers. I'm telling you.
That would be a story.
I'm telling you, he invited me up to Templemore Baths, and this was a couple of years ago, and I arrived, and there he was with his wee swimming cap on. Hello, Stephen. With his budgie smugglers.
I need to warn the staff that that's a possibility. What's a definite is that some of the houses on Templemore Avenue already are bedecked in Christmas decorations with 47 days to go.
Brilliant.
Stephen, you need to get your audience to talk about this. That's wrong.
Brilliant.
That's wrong.
It's brilliant. Oh, you can buy selection boxes at the moment, and that's right. And you can eat them in November, and that's right. How tough has this been, Connor?
I have to say that we did a bit of training and the training was kind of all right because we were doing it at our own pace. We had no real number to hit. We were just battering away at it, basically. And then we hit, I think, sort of Monday, first day in the pool. We did the show in the pool on Monday, so it was grand, right? Everyone was around us. Lots of cheering and whooping and hollering. Tuesday, we all had to hit somewhere between 70 and 80 lengths on our own. Wednesday, Stephen, was the hardest day. Every time you sat down, you fell asleep. Every time you went for a wee sort of just a wee moment of solace, your body just went, what are you doing? So yesterday wasn't as bad, and I'm hoping today is going to be a big crescendo. So it has been really, really tough, specifically Wednesday.
How tough have you found it, Mark? Because you
been
are
good
a swimmer,
fun,
aren't
Stephen.
You? You're one of those,
I am a swimmer.
You're
so
one of those mad people that goes cold water swimming.
Yes.
Buckler said he met you down in Bangor seafront one day, topless, just coming out of the pool. Hey, I don't think he's recovered.
It's very warm. It's very warm in November, so it's you can go taps off, no wetsuits. But Stephen, I tell you, what I've really enjoyed is the diversity of our team. We're totally cross-community. We've got Liverpool fans, we've got Manchester United fans, and we've crossed that biggest barrier of all between different BBC programmes. You know how tense it can get.
Departments.
Yeah, departments. Yeah. Departments. He started already. Mm. Kate Conway is here. She works with Vinny. Now, thanks, Stephen, for handing over Vinny. Kate, has it been good to get away from Vinny for a while?
It has. I'm surprised Vinny didn't join me in the pool. I thought he was going to, but he claimed that he couldn't swim. But thank goodness he stayed back at base.
He's too much of a star now for that, Kate, you see.
He's
too much of a star for this now, Kate. You've got to understand.
Stephen
this.
Is saying, Kate can't hear you, unfortunately, Stephen. I'm passing on that libelous comment. Oh, Connor's here.
What did
look
he
at
say?
This. He, say it again, Stephen.
I said he's too much of a star to get his wee feet wet now, Kate. You've got to understand.
Well,
you
right.
must know this.
You're right. He's back at base covered in glitter, waiting for us all to return.
Well, listen, Kate, it's a fantastic amount of money to have raised. I know we're bantering here, but it's incredible. Congratulations.
It really is. It's unbelievable, Stephen. I didn't think that I would be fit to swim as many lengths every day because I hadn't swam in a pool for a very, very long time. But what do you know? I got in and the first day I went from a training, I managed 40 lengths and then I just built up to doing the 68 lengths a day. But doing it 5 days in a row is when it really, I had underestimated how hard that was going to be because I came and did the swim every morning and then went into work. you know, we had the show at 6 o'clock, so there was a few afternoons where I was just a bit, could hardly string a sentence together, but thank goodness for Vinny.
Brilliant. And tell me this then, presumably people can continue to contribute to Children in Need and what you're doing and right up to Children in Need Day, Cale, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, donations are very gratefully received. Yes, you can still donate. There's still time to throw
bbc.co.uk/swim. Go on there. Not only can you get all the details of the people who've been doing this, like I said, 64,000 lengths we've set out to do. We're hoping to get that done by lunchtime today. And if people
what
want
are
to
you
give,
at the minute?
And they want to see. Well, I don't know. Collectively, we'll probably find out of the 64,000. We have to go across all the BBC colleagues and find out what they've done.
Oh, sorry, I've got some breaking news. They've just picked the team for next year. Let me just have a look.
Oh, look at that.
Vinny Hurl and Stephen Nolan. Yes. Oh, Stephen, you've been picked next year.
Yeah. Can you imagine me even doing one length? That would be fun. Okay, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Connor. Thank you, Kate. And thanks, Anne-Marie Wallace, as well, part of the team doing that for Children in Need this year. 03030 80 55 55. Let's look at the BBC's future next. The chairman of the BBC has warned the fight is on for the future of public service broadcasting. In a speech this week, Dr. Samir Shah said, with the rise of streaming, action is now needed to future-proof public service broadcasters. Otherwise, Dr. Shah says, our very British success story will be part of our past. He floated the idea of a permanent BBC charter instead of renewing it every 10 years, describing the current system as really odd. But should that be one way of securing the future of the BBC? Should public service broadcasting be protected at all? Spiked Online's Brendan O'Neill with us. Morning, Brendan.
Morning.
Good morning. Belfast Telegraph columnist Malachy O'Docherty. Morning, Malachy.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning. And of course, we'll get your views on this. How important is the BBC to you? How important is BBC Northern Ireland to you? Do you think it's good value for money? 03030 80 55 55. Malachy.
Well, I think public service broadcasting is crucial to the functioning of a proper democracy. I think what we've seen in the United States is the collapse of faith in what they call the mainstream media, and a sense that you know, there's more truth to be found on social media through TikTok, YouTube, and others. And I think that's calamitous. I think that's a very dangerous situation, and I think it's with us already. I mean, I often hear in conversation people coming out with absurdities like, you only hear lies on the BBC or the BBC's propaganda. And I mean, I believe that's nonsense. I have great faith in the BBC. I've been involved with the BBC for decades. I can criticise it as well as anybody. I know its failings. But I think that fundamentally, it's a cornerstone of democracy that we should have public service broadcasting. And I think the chair is right, Dr. Shah is right. There has to be a fight to save it. Now, how do you save it? The funding model is strange in a multimedia environment. The Royal Charter is strange. The one area in which the BBC is, I think, often contemptibly craven is in its dealings with royalty, its coverage of royalty.
But Malachy, maybe this question is too simplistic, but this talk about saving the BBC against the streamers, why is the bottom line not that the BBC will save itself if it makes enough good programming that will be so attractive to people that they'll watch it? Like, what is it beyond that? What is this fight to save it?
Well, it's the competition in the news environment, I think. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, obviously the BBC has to fight back against the popularization of citizen journalism and so on. The BBC has to assert its superior quality to the alternatives. That, in a sense, is making the same point that you're making. How does that bring money in? How does that secure its legitimacy for all time? You know, these are very difficult questions. But yes, I think the BBC essentially now has to more concentrate on news, you know, and local news as well than on you know, why compete with Netflix for drama when they're doing it well enough? Why compete with Prime and Disney? You know, for the if Disney wants to make Doctor Who, let them make Doctor Who. You know, they're part of it already. You know, so but news, the need for an informed populace in a democracy is hugely important. And when you have, when we've just seen across the Atlantic a polity in which a candidate for the presidency can talk bilge and spout nonsense and rubbish and get credibility for that and get endorsement from podcasters and people online, you know, that's a very, very dangerous situation. We need to lift the quality of public discourse, Brendan, and the way to do it is through public service broadcasting.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, but this idea of the BBC as a ship of truth in the sea of lies, I just find it very outdated, incredibly elitist. And the notion that we have this problematic populist citizen journalism and we need to counter it with the brave upper middle class souls of the BBC, I'm sorry, it doesn't wash anymore. And in fact, the events of the past week have demonstrated this because, you know, Trump largely circumvented the mainstream media. He went to the alternative media. He went to the broadcast podcast bros, and he spoke directly to his own audiences. And if you look at how the BBC has responded to his election, and we've just heard some of it there from Maliki, there's this utter bafflement that 72 million Americans, many of them working class Americans, good people, there's utter bafflement that they could vote for Trump. This suggests to me that the BBC and other journalists in the UK are really cut adrift from what's happening in society. They don't understand the societies they're supposed to be talking about, and that's a profound concern, I think.
Well, Brendan, you're interpreting things that I didn't say. I said nothing about elitism. I said nothing about the middle class. I agree with you that the BBC is not a ship of truth, if you like. I do believe in the human feelings of ordinary journalists, and I do believe that institutions have to be constantly reflecting on their own weaknesses and on their own established cultures. And that's right. And I do believe that the BBC needs to be in touch with people in all communities and at all levels. I do believe that the BBC pretty much is. I mean, there's nothing comparable within the cyberspace to local broadcasting, the dear connection that local BBC journalists in places like Derry, for instance, have with people on the ground and people in communities. So that is there. I mean, it is blithe and ill-informed to just dismiss that as middle-class elitism. The BBC, I mean, has had reporters on the ground in Beirut, in Kyiv, when the Russians were on the way, you know, and so the 40
as did Sky, as did ITN, as did lots of different news networks around the world. None of them funded by a license, a compulsory license fee.
And that is a problem, and I do worry about it. But I mean, I think if you have a compulsory license fee set by government, then you have a vulnerability in the BBC created by that. That's going to be dependent on the government.
Brendan,
if
your
that
turn.
Vulnerability is advertisers, that's another vulnerability. It's a greater one.
It seems to me that there's a section of society that kind of clings to the BBC as a life raft in a world that they find difficult to understand. I get that. I actually am not a traditional BBC basher. I think the ideal of public service broadcasting is a good ideal. There should be a broadcaster, I think, that's slightly above the fray and the kind of corporate media. I think that's a good idea, but it's an idea the BBC is not living up to very well at the moment. And I think the more
how do you make the case that I don't understand the world any better than you do? You know, how do you do that? How do you sit there and make an assumption that I'm talking about failure to understand the real world? Anything I said gives you that impression?
I'm sure you understand the world perfectly well, and I'm sure you understand it better than I do, given the job you do. I'm saying that there are people out there, for sure, and I meet them all the time, who see the BBC as a shield against the changing world. They don't like the rise of streaming. They don't like the rise of podcasts. They're terrified of Joe Rogan. I was on Joe Rogan a few months ago, and I can tell you, he's a nice guy, and his audience are good people. They're scared of these changes that are happening in the media, and in politics, after Brexit, after Trump. There is a section of society that doesn't understand this stuff, and they come to see the BBC more and more as their guard against it. But that's part of the problem.
Okay.
The public service broadcaster shouldn't serve just those people. we should serve the whole public.
Brendan, thank you. Malachy, thank you. I'm sure we'll continue talking about this. Next, the Irish government's been urged to consider setting up a scheme to regulate the use of cannabis and some other drugs, which are currently illegal, on a not-for-profit basis. The Committee for Drug Use, formed to examine and respond to the Citizens Assembly's recommendation, says that this should be considered in line with how other EU countries have regulated cannabis, including Spain and Germany. I've been speaking to the Green Party Senator, Mal O'Hara, and the commentator, Phil Kelly. I began by asking Mal how this would work.
Stephen, I suppose this is part of 59 recommendations. I've been on your show repeated times talking about the need to move on the wider issue around drugs to save lives and reduce harm. But specifically in terms of cannabis, the three countries that we suggested looking at were Malta, Spain and Germany, who already have some sort of legalised or regulation around cannabis consumption for personal use. So I'll talk about Malta first. That's about small amounts that are prescribed in the law, and they also allow cannabis social clubs on a not-for-profit basis. So the profit motive is removed. So it's not about selling and getting more people using. It's for those existing users that they can do it in a safe and regulated way, and which doesn't contribute to the criminal market for cannabis.
But it continues to feed their addiction, does it?
Yeah, well, Stephen, I think let's be clear about this, and I've said it repeatedly on your show numerous times, that in the entire of humankind, we've always used substances in one way or another. There is no way to police or criminal justice our way out of stopping people from taking substances. I think we have to be frank and realistic and say that that approach has failed. Instead, what we do is move to a human rights, health-based harm reduction model, and that will save lives.
But how does that not, Mal, then create a whole new generation of users? If our default position is, this is what people will do, so let's supply it to them in a safe way, why don't we give it to 18-year-olds in a safe way, as soon as they're an adult then?
Well, let's look at the example in Europe that has worked for the last 24 years, Stephen. Portugal. In 2000, Portugal decriminalised all substances for personal use. They have massively reduced HIV transmission through injecting needles. Their drug population in prison is much reduced. Their crime associated with drug use has reduced. And Portuguese young people are much less likely than their European peers to try substances. Now, what Portugal did was decriminalise, put money into services, prevention, treatment and support, but also put money into education so that people could make informed choices. And lo and behold, 24 years later, young people in Portugal are less likely to try drugs than their European peers. It's a win-win-win, and we should follow that model.
Phil Kelly.
Yeah, I think the idea of the normalisation of drug use, and particularly in cannabis, is unlikely to work. And it's a response to, as Mal has said, decades of failed policy, which has not delivered either. But I don't think the flip to normalisation is necessarily the right way to go, just to accept the problem and try and mitigate the worst aspects of it, while storing up longer-term problems. The problem is we've had decades of failed drug policy, but I do think we need to be pragmatic enough to say that any drug policy that can reduce use is the kind of path we should follow, but be very, very wary of treading the path towards normalisation. And the problem is, the reason why I don't think any, whether it be the draconian measures or the kind of liberal response to the drug problem, the reason why I don't think as a society we can find an answer is because in terms of our political leadership, our housing policy creates homelessness and insecurity. Our economic policy creates debt and poverty. Our health policy has created a crisis in services. And our society therefore reaps the diseases of despair that create the kind of foundational cracks in the society which many people are falling into. I think it speaks to a lack of ambition in kind of Western and European countries, that the response to the failed draconian measures is just to kind of give up and go down the route of normalisation. There are countries tackling this problem in a holistic way and reaping results, but I don't think we as a society have the kind of moral capacity or the material infrastructure to deal with it in any adequate way.
Mal.
Yeah, well, I refute very much everything that Phil has said. I think the evidence is staring him in the face when he looks at Portugal. But I think, Stephen, this is really important for us because Glasgow is moving ahead with an overdose prevention centre, and that's very welcome. Councillors in Belfast, none of the councillors in Belfast voted against my proposal a year and a half ago to establish one in the city. At that time, we had no executive instalment to move it forward. And in the Republic, they're moving to it's a health-based model, which will decriminalise drugs for personal use and regulate and legislate around cannabis. Now, it's up to the next It's up to the next government to implement that. And that's why we need Greens in government or there are other progressives to make sure that we continue a pace with drug reform. But Stephen, we need to save lives. You know, you've been on the streets. You've done programmes about it. A police or criminal justice response is not going to save any of those people that you talk to. We need a health-based human rights harm reduction model that will save lives. And I hope the political ambition in the North reflects some of what's been done in the Republic.
I absolutely support the notion of treating this as a health-based issue. If we're going to treat, as the kind of liberal response says, drug use as a health-based issue, we also need to understand that normalising drug use is wrong from a health-based point of view. You cannot chemically alter the brain or take substances in any safe way. That needs to be part of how we talk about drugs, how we educate young people. There's no safe consumption. But also in terms of treatment, we have to understand that when somebody has got to a level of addiction where they're lying comatose on a city centre street and they're leaving hypodermic needles in children's play parks, the treatment shouldn't be voluntary in that aspect. The treatment should be enforced. I'm not saying about criminalising people, but they need to get the treatment. The problem is our society doesn't have the capacity to deliver that treatment, and that's why this problem will go unsolved. And all the rhetoric from left and right isn't going to solve it. We don't have the capacity or the will.
Yeah, well, we heard significant evidence, and I know Phil's a commentator, but the evidence that I listened to over the summer was from GPs, was from pharmacists, was from frontline drug workers, was from the prison service, was an academic.
Yes, but let's address the issue of all enforced of those, treatment.
But
let's
all,
enforce,
and,
let's address and, that issue. Would you support
and
enforced
flatly,
treatment?
Flatly, there was not no very limited support for enforced treatment, Stephen. And we had a really rigorous debate about the idea of, you know, say you're caught with small amount of substances repeatedly, do we eventually reach a point where we say you're mandated or you're enforced to go to treatment? And we suggested that actually the evidence suggests that that doesn't work. We need
Stephen,
to
Stephen, we need to We need to also have
it. Services, sorry,
we need
Phil,
to have, yeah.
If you can provide health-based holistic services which address people's other ills, you know, we know that those who are problematic in their drug use often have adverse childhood experiences. There's poverty, there's homelessness. So there's a whole plethora of other social ills that we need to address alongside this. But decriminalisation for personal use is a good of itself, and it's a good first step forward. We then need to address the supply side, so criminals, paramilitaries are making profit off people's misery, and we need to address the other social ills in terms
much,
of poverty.
Much of that I agree with, but yeah. But communities have the right to say that their streets shouldn't be littered with the trash of drug paraphernalia, which is dangerous for children. We've seen instances where children have picked this up, and therefore when somebody has got themselves to that level, then they need to receive treatment, whether they're in capacity or not. Now, you talk about Europe. China has dealt with this issue. In 2022, the number of drug users in China has been declining for six straight years, while the number of drug users who relapse has been falling for 12 consecutive years. And they have exactly what Mal is talking about, that holistic approach, which is treatment, which is dealing with people's insecurity around housing and employment, all those things and their welfare. But as I said, the kind of depressing note is we as a society have got ourselves to the position where we don't have the capacity to solve this problem. I don't think draconian measures work on their own, and I don't think the idea of normalising drug use is going to work either. We've got ourselves into a problem, and we should be blaming those who are in power for creating the kind of social conditions that has created this mess. But I think it's a lack of ambition when you say, just let's open up cannabis clubs. Does anybody be a better parent when they're on cannabis? Do they be a better worker? Do they be a better member of the community when they're cannabis? Why promote this? We shouldn't promote it. We need to educate people against drug use.
Hey, let us know what you think at home this morning. 030 30 80 55 55. Final word to you, Mal.
Yeah, thanks. And look, I think unfortunately Phil used some right-wing dog whistles there about, you know, allowing people to do this. The reality is that people have always taken substances in one form or another, and we have to address it alongside the other social ills. We can save lives, and rather than moralise, which does nothing and saves nobody or reduces no harm, we need to take this approach. And I go back.
I think the hypocrisy of that statement from a Green Party member is absurd.
Very, very clear here. Phil might be party political and attacking my party, but in fact, anybody in the conversation around drug decriminalisation and reducing harm and saving lives in Northern Ireland knows that I've been a vocal proponent on this issue, and I'm delighted to have been able to contribute to that committee to see progressive recommendations, which it's up to the next government to implement. And ultimately, if they do, we'll save lives and reduce harm.
Okay, Mal and Phil, thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's about it from us for today. I'm on 5 Live all weekend, so we start across the UK and the Nolan Show on 5 Live tonight at 10 o'clock. Or we'll see you back here, BBC Radio Ulster, 9 o'clock Monday morning. Whichever way, have a good weekend, everyone, and thanks very much for listening all week. Bye-bye.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.